Hello and welcome to Liberty Southwest podcast number 4. I am Matt Winter. We've got Eric Taylor, Chelsea Camo, Mike Lensgrave, Kirk Pettis, Danny Ning, and Lydia Tabbitt. We've got a full house tonight, and we're going to be talking about the Federal Reserve System and monetary policy. One topic.
Can we start by talking about David Fitzsimmons real quick?
Let's do it. Let's do it, Kirk.
All right. So, this last weekend, there was the BPOU in Wright County, and David Fitzsimmons was being challenged for the endorsement of the Republican Party, and we are all very familiar with that since we were involved 2 years ago. And so, anyways, he lost the endorsement, and it was just
he
brought back a lot of memories from 2 years ago. But what was that, Eric?
He withdrew.
Yeah, go ahead, Eric.
He withdrew because he wasn't making it?
No, he didn't lose.
Would there have been a no endorsement or?
Possibly, but he just decided to not even run for the endorsement.
Yeah, and he's already agreed to not primary if he didn't win the endorsement.
Yep.
But,
he decided
so
to
the other guy won endorsement then, correct?
Well, he was unopposed.
Oh, because
Because it was like a mathematical impossibility for him to win, right? For Fitzsimmons to win.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, did he back out before the BPOU or during the BPOU?
During.
Yeah, okay. So, I mean, the way it worked when we were doing it 2 years ago, I assume it went through at least one ballot before he would back out.
No.
But
The thing that surprised me was that it was so early, because I remember in 2012 when we had our endorsing convention for state rep, it wasn't until end of May or early, it was like May 31st or something, wasn't it?
I think that was the state convention.
Ours was in March.
Well, yeah, no, the state convention was in like early, mid-May, but the endorsing convention for the SC33 candidates was also like end of May.
It was only like 3 weeks before the state convention.
No, it was after the state convention.
Was it?
Yeah. No, it has to be before.
Yeah, it was before.
To become a delegate to the state is at the
BPOU. Honestly, it wasn't. It wasn't. You want to know how I know? It was because it was after because I remember talking to Chris Turnholm there afterwards, and then remember he passed away like a week later. And that was SD33. It was in Wayzata. You guys may not have been there. Eric was there, I know.
Matt was there as well.
Matt was there, too.
The state convention.
Yeah, I'm not in SD33, so I wasn't at that one. But
yeah, you're in 47.
That was right when we were starting to kick off this whole gig.
Yeah, that was when we endorsed Cindy Pugh and Dave Osmick, and there was that whole thing with Connie.
Oh, you're right. That was before the state convention. But the state convention
after.
That I'm thinking
it was
of
after.
Was...
It was after. It was after.
No, it can't be after.
It was after.
It was after.
I will bet money it was after.
Yeah.
But anyways.
Oh, wait. Yeah, you're right, because I didn't run for that convention, of course. I don't know what I'm talking about.
Yeah, it's beside the point, but I was
But how do you go to the state convention if it's after the state convention for SD33?
They're separate.
That's not what the endorsing convention was for. It was for endorsing the representatives.
I just thought it was interesting that the Wright County convention was so early.
Yeah.
It was only that SD33 was only for endorsing a candidate. It wasn't for any delegates then. So, anyways, so yeah, it's since we've all been pretty active in politics the last few years, it brought back a lot of memories and how I can't remember the guy's name. Who was the opponent of Fitzsimmons there?
Eric Lucero.
And so, yeah, he obviously had stacked the delegates from the caucus, and he did the legwork to win the endorsement, which is the way to do it. It's just pretty funny how he went about doing it because of this whole bill that was passed in Minnesota to legalize gay marriage.
What I know about this, and obviously I've only talked to a couple people, but what I understand about it is that that there was a group that had kind of organized to target David Fitzsimmons because of his vote on gay marriage last year, in which he had committed to voting yes on gay marriage if there was like some sort of amendment to the bill that protected churches from not having to marry gay couples. It was like some sort of religious freedom amendment that he had said he would, if it was added to the bill, he would support the gay marriage bill, I think. It was something along those lines. And so there was a group in Wright County that was organizing to challenge him on that. And then I think... Well, yeah, go ahead.
I'm just saying,
Lydia, it was about... It wasn't... It was specifically... He had to vote for it to become a committee member. I can't remember the exact committee. But he was the one that proposed the amendment that of the gay marriage bill that was passed, that he proposed the amendment, got it passed, that made it that churches could not be sued if they said that's not in our religion, we're not going to marry
sort of religious freedom amendment that he proposed, that and then he voted for it once that was added on.
Yeah. So essentially,
also, I think Eric had also told me there was also. Some sort of question about like some of his funding or like his they had kind of targeted or had challenged him on some sort. Eric would knows more about this, but like his girlfriend was on like a lobbying group or something that was affiliated with
his girlfriend's a Democrat, but that's besides the point. The whole fact was that he made the bill. Which, you know,
exactly Republican.
I thought it was no matter about the bill, but he granted liberty to churches to not be sued because all these churches that don't believe in gay marriage would have to be forced to marry same-sex couples. And if they didn't, they could be sued. So his amendment was purely as more of a liberty amendment, in my opinion.
It's a pragmatic amendment.
It's what needed to be in there. And by him doing this, he got ostracized by his count, you know, from some religious fanatics in his district that are claimed to be Republican.
Yeah.
And they campaigned for the last year. Fitzsimmons was a rookie, you know, congressman for Minnesota.
Yeah.
And he, you know, so he was new to the game and he didn't do his part. That he needed to do that was necessary, and
this is the thing I think that people are most upset about is the way in which they targeted him. It sounded like they I know there was some sort of issue with the Taxpayers League and like sending out like this is I think what they were doing during the convention was they sent out some sort of like note or like memo or something. This guy Phil Krenke, who's also running for the U.S. 6th congressional district that Michelle Bachmann is retiring from, that Tom Emmer. Yeah, he's also running, and he had sent out some sort of memo or something, I guess, with Taxpayers League.
Well, he used the letterhead from the
letterhead.
He used to be the chair or the president or whatever, and now he just sits on the board. Mm-hmm. And he went outside the Taxpayers League Fitzsimmons had 100% backing from the Taxpayers
League. Yeah, but because he didn't sign some sort of pledge, they were saying like, oh, he never signed the Taxpayers League pledge, even though he had 100% approval rating from that organization or something. Well, that was
the guy that he was running.
I feel like we should go back. We should probably start on our actual topic here pretty quick.
Are you kidding me?
No? Oh, okay. Maybe not.
Well, I mean, in terms of liberty, I think that this is a great topic. I mean, we talk about the government party, which, I mean, and I shouldn't say we. I talk about the government party, and I kind of lump the Republicans and the Democrats together as far as this is concerned, because we talk about gay marriage, and, like, one of my best friends is a Lutheran pastor. I don't happen to be Lutheran, but... He was really nervous about allowing gays to marry because he was concerned that he would be forced to either marry gay couples within his church, which is against his particular religion, or that he would be subject to litigation. And on either side, I think we have to say, what is everyone's freedom here? What is the liberty at stake? And I'd say to both sides, yeah, go ahead. If two consenting adults want to get married, that's none of my business, you know, neither is it the business of the church. Now, at that same time, it is the business of the church to dictate what they will and will not do within their religion. And I think that any church has the right to say whether or not they're going to marry a gay couple or whatever they want to do within the confines of their religious beliefs. And that's the entire point of the conversation.
Right.
The Constitution says, you know, you have the freedom of religion, and that just the whole aspect of forcing a religion to marry someone that goes against the morality of the religion or the beliefs of the religion is totally asinine. And that's not freedom of religion. And that's the state dictating what a religion can and cannot do, which is very opposed from what exactly what Chelsea said for liberty and for our general liberties, even at that. And it would have harmful effects throughout the entire state and nation if it followed suit. And what Fitzsimmons did should have been done, and he was obviously probably picked to do it. I think that any Republican should have stood up and do that. And I can't believe it, even Democrats would even do it. It's not like religious people are only following the Republican ticket. So what Fitzsimmons did was perfectly, I support what Fitzsimmons did. And I was shocked to hear how the whole thing panned out. And why I want to bring this up is just to relate the division between the social aspects versus the liberty aspects in the Republican Party, since we were all delegates 2 years ago and had seen this process. And that was kind of the fight we had back then. And it was monetary policy and social agenda policy.
Well, and I've always found it to be, that's the biggest difference between our goal and the, as far as the group that we would have the biggest amount of problems with is the social conservatives. Amongst the Republicans, the neocons are not the worst. The normal Republicans, and then the social conservatives are the ones that I have the biggest problem with, at least personally. The people who are trying to push their moral agenda through public policy, and I think what we've seen is that is where we see a fallout amongst the common voters. So if you wanted to push an agenda and you wanted to come up with a group of people to do it through it, and you want to do it from a liberty perspective, and you want to do something like marijuana legalization, you're not going to do it in the Republican Party in this state because of that fact.
I don't know. I can see at least for sure medical marijuana, possibly like legalization of marijuana as like something that's will be in the state legislatures this session, if not soon.
What I'm saying is the people who will oppose it are going to be the social conservatives.
Well, but let's look at what just transpired. So a representative did something that needed to be done. That amendment needed to be in that bill. And the social conservatives came in and threw him out of office. And that's going to have ripple effects. And that's where it makes me just want to throw my hands and be done with any part of the Republican Party. For the social conservatives to come ramrod through and destroy liberty, I guess is what it is. Because to me, why I got involved in politics is this micromanaging meddling that all these politicians are doing, and it's destroying America. And from what the Republican, if this is a trend that's going to transpire, the Republican Party is only going to suffer greatly from this. And it's an embarrassment, and it should be looked at as an embarrassment. You do not legislate morality. And listening to talk shows this morning, it was pretty funny, all the people calling in and hearing what they had, how they were defending themselves and what transpired. And I don't know, it was the whole purpose of that I wanted to bring this up was the fact of the division in the Republican Party, and it's the division of us, the liberties versus the social conservatives. And I just would, yeah, just wanted to bring up dialect around that to see if that had any influence on you guys, or if that, you know, for the way of the future, would you want to fight harder in the future to become a more, you know, to be more part of the process to make sure these social conservatives get out of the Republican Party, or should we just forget about it and move on to the Libertarian Party?
I think the issue, one of the issues is the fact that really in a, almost any district or BPOU, the majority of the voters are socially conservative still.
And where did this start from? I think I think the Republicans are sowing their own defeat from this, because they had to do this a few years ago to fight the gay marriage, and they made this whole issue that, that riled up this social conservative in the party, and I think they're really sowing their seeds now from the damage that they sowed back then.
Yeah, there are a lot of, you know, individuals I've talked to who really, you know, have an issue with potentially an agenda from that side. They think it's a radicalized side, and they think it's a threat to family, to you know good units, and they believe that firmly. You're not going to, you know, you're not going to tell them any difference. And I, you know, personally, I think it's just a matter of time before those individuals just are out of the party. So you can get frustrated with the fact that they're there. But there's really a different mindset, when you get, you know, under 40. It's not really a conversation. So, and when you skew older, and that's really, those are the individuals who are more active in politics. They really have an anti, homosexual sentiment. It's just the way it is. So I don't really get too excited about it. I view it as something that will change eventually because of more tolerant attitudes, but it's, for the time being, it's going to be, you know, it's going to be a point of conflict.
Yeah, and well, that's the thing. I have all respect for people fighting for what they believe in, but when it starts to mandate things over people, that's where I draw the line. And it's really just sheds
a bad light
on the Republican Party. And
it'll go away over time.
I think there's opportunity in this as well, just to promote liberty as well. I mean, because people are going to throw this in our face, and it's like, no, this is not what we're about. And so I think there's plenty of opportunity, because obviously the idea of liberty is so far removed from people's mindsets that if they can't see the light from what they're trying to do right now and how it can be done against them, it makes no sense, and it's a losing battle, and we should try and get in front of this to bring all things back to liberty from this matter, to argue it not is gay marriage right or wrong. It's about legislating the legislature, the laws that are written to affect personal choice, your pursuit of happiness, and it's right or wrong, that's not our place to decide.
Yeah, this is my personal reaction to everything that went on this weekend is that I'm just so over this marriage issue in the Republican Party. And I mean, I really attribute it to what caused the Minnesota state legislature to flip from DFL to, or Republican to DFL majority. And I've been, even just here in Madison the last like couple of weeks, I've been working with some Liberty people, and we had our caucus this last weekend, and I've just been like screaming till I'm blue in the face about that they have to get ahead of this issue. Otherwise, I can totally see it coming here too. But I really can. But I mean, my personal opinion is to approach it the way they are. And I think Oklahoma, where they're just trying to get the government out of it entirely. But I think the biggest loss from this weekend was just the loss of Dave Fitzsimmons to those that are trying to advance liberty in the Republican Party, because he was one of the few people that was like sort of a bridging effort between what you would consider liberty and Tea Party people and kind of establishment Republicans. So I think that was sort of the biggest loss, is that there's a very few people that have kind of been able to bridge that gap. And so his loss will definitely be felt in that regard, I think.
And I think he kind of got burned by stating to voters when he's running that he wouldn't support any, you know, type of gay marriage amendment, and he mm-hmm. ended up putting legislation into a bill which didn't actually get passed. The amendment got passed, but he put legislation into a bill really protecting churches, and it was kind of spun as going back against what he had previously said, and mm-hmm. and he did say, yeah, I did change my mind in a way, I've explained why. One of the stronger forces during the BPLU convention was the Minnesota Family Council, and they identified the fact that the majority, almost the complete list of his large donors were outside of his district, and they were even outside the states, in California, New York, California, Pennsylvania, Colorado, Massachusetts, and they kind of painted him as someone that he wasn't. But it was almost like a trap that he walked into, and it was really unfortunate.
Yeah.
Well, I have a prediction. I predict this and the Democrat fight at their caucus that happened a week ago or 2 weeks ago is going to pretty much be one of the last few straws of the caucus part, or like the caucus system in Minnesota. They've been talking about ended for a while now. And these two events, I think politicians would rather see the caucus system go away. And I think this will lead towards that end.
You know, I think that what it really comes down to for me is just understanding the base root. Morality should not be legislated. The entire point of this country is that we're going to have a ton of people from different ethnicities, different religious beliefs, or maybe not religious at all. And the entire point is that we're going to live side by side and be neighbors with people who we're not going to agree with. We're not going to have the same beliefs. And they might do things that we would find maybe sinful or offensive, but the entire point is that we can live in a country where we can live our own lives, not other people's lives, but our own lives according to what we really believe in. And the second we start legislating morality, we're taking that right away from other people. And the second you start attacking other people's liberties and you put that on the table, is that something that is government's place? Then where does it end? And if you think that only other people's rights are going to get taken away and yours aren't, then you're foolish.
No doubt. I think on that note, why don't we shift over to our main topic of the Federal Reserve and monetary policy. Eric, I think you've got a few clips prepared for us. Did you have any comments that you wanted to open up for any of those, or?
Well, I have a decent clip that can really lay the framework for the discussion, so I'll go ahead and play it now.
A number of years ago, the Central Bank of the United States, the Federal Reserve, produced a document entitled Modern Money Mechanics. This publication detailed the institutionalized practice of money creation as utilized by the Federal Reserve and the web of global commercial banks it supports. On the opening page, the document states its objective. The purpose of this booklet is to describe the basic process of money creation in a fractional reserve banking system. It then proceeds to describe this fractional reserve process through various banking terminology, a translation of which goes something like this. The United States government decides it needs some money, so it calls up the Federal Reserve and requests, say, $10 billion. The Fed replies, saying, sure, we'll buy $10 billion in government bonds from you. So the government takes some pieces of paper, paints some official-looking designs on them, and calls them treasury bonds. Then it puts a value on these bonds to the sum of $10 billion, and sends them over to the Fed. In turn, the people at the Fed draw up a bunch of impressive pieces of paper themselves, only this time calling them Federal Reserve Notes, also designating a value of $10 billion to the SEC. The Fed then takes these notes and trades them for the bonds. Once this exchange is complete, the government then takes the $10 billion in Federal Reserve Notes and deposits it into a bank account. And upon this deposit, the paper notes officially become legal tender money, adding $10 billion to the U.S. money supply. And there it is. $10 billion in new money has been created. Of course, this example is a generalization, for, in reality, this transaction would occur electronically, with no paper used at all. In fact, only 3% of the U.S. money supply exists in physical currency. The other 97% essentially exists in computers alone. Now, government bonds are, by design, instruments of debt. And when the Fed purchases these bonds, with money it essentially created out of thin air, the government is actually promising to pay back that money to the Fed. In other words, the money was created out of debt. This mind-numbing paradox of how money or value can be created out of debt or a liability will become more clear as we further this exercise. So, the exchange has been made and now $10 billion sits in a commercial bank account. Here's where it gets really interesting. For as based on the fractional reserve practice, that $10 billion deposit instantly becomes part of the bank's reserves, just as all deposits do. And regarding reserve requirements, as stated in modern money mechanics, a bank must maintain legally required reserves equal to a prescribed percentage of its deposits. It then quantifies this by stating, under current regulations, the reserve requirement against most transaction accounts is 10%. This means that with a $10 billion deposit, 10%, or $1 billion, is held as the required reserve, while the other $9 billion is considered an excessive reserve and can be used as the basis for new loans. Now, it is logical to assume that this $9 billion is literally coming out of the existing $10 billion deposit. However, this is actually not the case. What really happens is that the $9 billion is simply created out of thin air on top of the existing $10 billion deposit. This is how the money supply is expanded. As stated in modern money mechanics, of course they, the banks, do not really pay out loans from the money they receive as deposits. If they did this, no additional money would be created. What they do when they make loans is to accept promissory notes, loan contracts, in exchange for credits, money, to the borrower's transaction accounts. In other words, the $9 billion can be created out of nothing simply because there is a demand for such a loan and that there is a $10 billion deposit to satisfy the reserve requirements. Now, let's assume that somebody walks into this bank and borrows the newly available $9 billion. They will then most likely take that money and deposit it into their own bank account. The process then repeats, for that deposit becomes part of the bank's reserves. 10% is isolated, and in turn 90% of the $9 billion, or $8.1 billion, is now available as newly created money for more loans. And, of course, that $8.1 can be loaned out and redeposited, creating an additional $7.2 billion, to $6.5 billion, to $5.9 billion, etc. This deposit money creation loan cycle can technically go on to infinity. The average mathematical result is that about $90 billion can be created on top of the original $10 billion. In other words, for every deposit that ever occurs in the banking system, about nine times that amount can be created out of thin air.
So that's a good overview of fractional reserve banking, which is that basically...
That was Zeitgeist, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah, I thought so. I recognize Peter Joseph's voice.
Yeah. It's one of the better clips that kind of, in my mind, captured how the Federal Reserve operates.
Yeah, I think it's great. He does a really good job.
Yeah.
One thing that should just quickly be mentioned is that, and if you couldn't tell from the clip, for anybody listening that doesn't already know this, which is a lot of people, unfortunately, is that the Federal Reserve is not the government. They are a separate private entity. And that's something that a lot of people don't know. I'll talk to my friends and I'll take out a dollar bill and I'll say, who makes this? And they'll say, oh, the government does. And it's very, very tricky. It's almost like hiding in plain sight. I mean, they've got their president's faces on there. It says the United States of America. It's got all our little emblems, you know, pictures of the signature of the secretary.
Hey, someone's got to be on mute.
Hey, Mike, I think your phone's picking up a little wind.
When you're not talking, hit mute button in the bottom left corner.
Okay.
So, I mean, I just think it's imperative if anybody wants to understand that the Federal Reserve is not the government. Not the government at all. They're not even a nonprofit organization.
Oh, they're a for-profit bank. It's a multitude of private banks. So,
sure.
Yeah, they cannot be audited.
That's why they don't want to be audited.
No, they can be audited by a congressional vote, but it hasn't happened in many, many, many years.
Can we talk more about that? Because a lot of people say, oh, that's not true. You know, the Fed gets audited all the time. They get audited by the Government Accountability Office, the GAO. They have their own internal audits. So we don't need a bill like Ron Paul's bill to audit the Fed. That's just redundant. All Ron Paul wants to do is make it so that Congress can dictate monetary policy, which would not be good. Does anyone have like a good rebuttal to that claim?
But that's the problem with internal auditors. Their internal auditors' interest is within the Federal Reserve. I mean, there's that bias right there. So, you know, even if they're being audited by internal auditors, their interest is with the Federal Reserve. I mean, you know, yeah, they're kind of separate, but, you know, I foresee that, you know, it's not independent. That's the problem. So.
Yeah, no, I agree. But there's also the GAO, which audits them. And then people claim that there's other private independent companies that audit them as well. I've yet to have been produced with any proof of these companies, but the GAO does audit them as well, I guess.
However, I would say until you've seen the results of an audit that are truly public knowledge and you can see the books for what they are, they're all just hand waving. There's no real auditing going on.
Yeah, no.
Well, as an accountant, I can say, you know, just personally, I have. I worked for a nonprofit, so we were required to go through independent audits annually. And I can say, to speak to, was it Danny who was saying about the independent auditors or the internal auditors?
Yeah, that's, yep.
Internal auditors are employees of the company itself. And like you said, their main goal is, you know, their alliance is with the company. Now, if there's an external audit, I can say personally, there's still going to be a conflict of interest. And we saw that very clearly with the Arthur Andersen fall. I mean, especially when you get to a big enough size, because when you have an external audit, there's a tricky relationship that goes on there because the company being audited pays the CPA
firm to
do the audit. And so as much as we try and say independent and as much as we can hope that there is, you know, an unbiased opinion, there's always going to be a little bit of a conflict of interest because essentially that external auditing agency is the client of the company that they're auditing.
No, I agree. I mean, it's still better than, you know, just having government auditors doing this. But, you know, I mean, for my company, we use KPMG as our auditors and, you know, we always, you know, we pay them to audit us. Obviously, you know, they need to keep us happy. So obviously, you know, to do that, sometimes they kind of have to, like, you know, give us some leeway and things like that. So, you know, that kind of compromises some independence. So I agree. But, you know,
when you say that, it totally reveals the sinisterness of the Federal Reserve auditing. Because the people who write the currency obviously have the ability to create quite a damn bit of it. So the internal auditors trying to keep people happy, what do you think they're going to do?
Yeah.
Well, until you see it in a public until the freedom of information you can gather the audit that was done internally. Yeah, I audited myself last night. I look great. That's all I can say. That's how I'd respond to that.
And here's another interesting point. Even if we, you know, and I want to hear what you guys think. Even if, you know, an external auditor does audit the Federal Reserve, like, what are the standards? Like, what is considered independent? What is the external auditor going to do? You know, a lot of these, like, public accounting firms, you know, they have to abide to, like, PCAOB standards. PCAOB is Public Company Accounting Standard Boards or whatever. But yeah, I mean, they have guidance in public accounting, but, you know, in terms of auditing the Federal Reserve, like, what is the metric? You know, how do we do it? Like, honestly, I don't have that answer. I don't know what you guys think about that.
I don't think there is an answer because we don't know what to audit, right? And one of the criticisms or one of the questions is, you know, what's going out of the United States? What's going from the Federal Reserve to the Bank of International Settlements to the Central Bank of Europe? How are they, you know, how are they funding other banks? How are they doing cash swaps, that type of thing? You know, you have to have an organization that really understands what the Federal Reserve is doing to, you know, to really pull up a full and comprehensive audit, right?
Well, and in addition to that, not only auditing, you know, how they're funding other banks and different things of that nature, but also really keeping in mind the effects of contracting the money supply or expanding it. I mean, that you can really control an entire economy if you can control the money supply. I know that the fiat system has come under attack over and over again whenever the economy goes downward. However, I think the really big question that we need to look at is the money supply in and of itself. So if you can have a private organization deciding to contract the money supply and push us into a recession, and even if they do it all legitimately, that's still quite a lot of power that's held within a private enterprise.
Oh, absolutely. And when you bring this up, it just reminds me of my homeboy Thomas Jefferson. He said, if the American people ever allow private banks to control the issue of their currency, first by inflation, then by deflation, the banks and corporations that grow up around them will deprive the people of all property until their children wake up homeless on the continent their fathers conquered. I believe that the banking institutions are more dangerous to our liberties than standing armies. The issuing power should be taken from the banks and restored to the people to whom it properly belongs.
Absolutely. And, I mean, if you think about the system, I mean, if I were a banker, I mean, they're doing it all right. I mean, because what you can do is then print all this money and then get this really strong economy and everybody's doing well. The money's flowing. I mean, look at the 90s. Everybody thought that they were just a genius in the stock market because everyone was winning. And then they're taking out all these loans, buying these really expensive homes, and they think that things are going to continue to go in that direction. Well, then they can contract the money supply. And then people go into foreclosure and they can't afford their nice things anymore. And then they can buy up real estate for pennies on the dollar. And that's exactly what we're seeing now. I mean, it's a brilliant system.
Or they can buy government bonds like Nathan Mayer Rothschild did after the Battle of Waterloo. Because him and his brother were financing both sides of the war. They had access to, privy to, you know, good information. They had runners that were ahead of the government runners. So when Nathan's runner got back with the news that the British won a full day ahead of the government runner, he sold all his stocks and bonds, and everyone triggered a panic sell-off because everyone thought the British lost. So the stocks tanked, bonds tanked, and when he bought them up for pennies on the dollar. And by the time the news came back that the British won, he was the richest man in England.
Right.
Oh, yeah. We see it again and again, don't we? I mean, history does repeat itself. You just got to know what history to listen to. And I can tell you, it's not the one that you hear in our public education system.
Well, if you think the extremely wealthy in the world are idiots, you're gravely mistaken. They're very intelligent people, and they know how to repeat history. They make it happen.
Well, they've got the power and the control, and apparently we don't mind giving it to them.
Absolutely not.
I think it's really, you know, how it's appalling how, like, the audacity the Fed has, like Bernanke testifying before Congress. I can't remember who he was talking to, but I think it might have been Alan Grayson, but because he's grilled the Fed pretty hard a couple of times. There's some good videos, like with the $9 trillion missing that the inspector general of the Fed has no idea where it went. And he's like, I'm shocked that, you know, this is the inspector general of the Federal Reserve and she has no idea where this $9 trillion went. But there's another one where he's questioning Bernanke about loans made to banks overseas. And he's like, will you tell us which banks got the loans? And Bernanke's just straight up, no. It's like, wow, you got some balls on you.
Well, we don't even know where any of this quantitative easing is flowing to.
Yeah, that's true.
Well, most of the quantitative easing is flowing into real estate market. QE3. It's flowing into mortgage-backed securities, and you know it's been a longer effort to rehabilitate the housing market and the economy through the housing market.
Well, that's because they're flowing, you know, where they're flowing. They're not flowing to people like you, me, or, you know, the next door neighbor. They're all going to the banks or, you know, the rich, the financial institutions, et cetera, et cetera.
Yep.
And I think it's nice to note, when we talk about the rich, we're not talking about people that got a couple million dollars. We're talking about like a tenth of a percent of the world that has an overwhelming majority of power. We're not talking about the mom and pop shops that have worked their tail off, built their business, and now they've got a couple million dollars. No. We're talking about people with, you know, billions and billions and billions of dollars, the Rothschilds, the Morgans, et cetera.
Yep.
I mean, because, like, so as an accountant, I hear a lot of people talk about taxes. Yeah, of course. And when they talk about tax legislation, they talk about closing these loopholes. And they try, you know, making these tax reforms for people who are making, you know, $1 million a year, a couple hundred thousand dollars a year. Well, what they fail to understand is this. When you make tax reform that's targeted towards the high earners, people that are as rich as, you know, the Morgans and the, you know, the whoever, they've got the best damn teams of accountants out there. And regardless of what kind of reform you've got, they're not going to be paying taxes. And they have enough money to be able to put it in, you know, and so what, who you end up attacking is really the middle class.
Not only that.
The middle class smaller.
Well, they've got the ability, though, as being that wealthy, is they can just say, well, I'm just not going to make any money until this legislation turns around. So they can sit on that policy. They've already got the money that they need. And then as long as they've got their money hidden away well enough, like you said, as you've got the extremely talented accountants, they got nothing to worry about.
It's not that. They can just take their money out and put it in foreign banks or whatnot that doesn't – through the fractional reserve system, is so it doesn't, it shortens the money supply, which creates a recession.
You know, and it's a variety of different methods that you use, whether it's putting it in a foreign bank account or holding on to it or finding the loopholes or even getting a marginal percentage of your investment back. So for example, gosh, I'm trying to remember exactly what it was, but if you buy a local or municipality bonds, those are tax-free. So you can take advantage of earning completely tax-free, income tax-free, I should say. And if you've got that amount of money, that's still going to yield you quite a bit of profit. And
yeah, but
so,
they suck. Municipal bonds, oh my God.
Oh, they're not, well, for you and I mean, if we've only got a couple hundred or a couple thousand dollars to invest, that's not a lot of money. But if you're talking about the big time dollars that these guys have, that adds up. And that's just one example, of course.
Yeah. We always hear about Warren Buffett, you know, talking about you know, I think I hear him from time to time saying, you know, yeah, it's a good time to invest in municipal bonds. But yeah, I mean, this guy is, you know, one of the richest people in the world. So, you know, putting money in municipal bonds for him is, you know, yeah, the percentages are low, but, you know, still like the dollars that he's getting from these interests, it's like astronomical. It's unbelievable.
Well, and I guess I just get really frustrated when I talk to people like you and I who are in, you know, we're obviously peons in the system, who say, yeah, let's attack the rich. And I mean, even moral judgments aside, I mean, let's not even discuss the morality of wealth distribution, redistribution. Let's just keep that off the table. But even so, understanding that any of this legislation where you try to attack the rich is not going to work. All it is going to keep the people who've really busted their butts to try and get what they are. Those are the people you're holding down.
Mm-hmm. Well, but I don't think we should talk about people making money and not. I think we should talk about more of the policy-wise and the effects it creates. If our government has the opportunity to create so much money by just loaning, I mean, setting up, putting out these bonds, the banks do a fractional reserve, this money's compounded, and it all creates this false dichotomy of an economy. The more money, the merrier, I guess, to go around the system, but it's the system of control is what it really is. It's the way it's set up to control and manipulate the markets that is the damning effect. Not just that, these few people are making buco bucks off that matter, but it's
right. And that wasn't my qualm at all.
I know, but it's where
throw a little pin out there for anybody who wants to try and tax the really rich if they think that's going to work. That's not the way to do it. That's my only little idea to throw out there. Commentary.
It ends up making me less money.
Exactly.
So as far as monetary policy goes, not just the Federal Reserve, monetary policy in general, I personally believe that having a solid commodity-backed currency is the correct way to go. However, I don't know how pragmatic that is in these times. And the reason I say that is because I don't know how easily we could get together the huge amount of money that it would take to make up the difference between the funny money that we have today and what would be a real solidly backed currency.
That would require a price correction.
That's exactly right. And the other thing that I was going to make a point on was let's talk about cryptocurrencies where you've got money that's based on a limited amount based on a cryptographic algorithm. And that is that a good substitution for solid currency policy?
It's interesting to think that the Federal Reserve was created because of the harsh boom and bust associated with a commodity-backed currency. That was the argument that was used to implement the Federal Reserve. There was a panic 4 or 5 years before the founding of the institution, and there had been severe panics as a result of a gold-backed currency, which the J.P. Morgan and others used to justify putting in a central bank. The upside was deflation. You know, things as a result of improvements in industrial processes, agricultural processes, things actually got cheaper. So a piece of clothing that would have cost $5 in 1810 would have cost $2.50 in 1910. We're certainly not used to that now, but there were severe panics, and the argument was the Federal Reserve could come in and soften the blow that was a result of these panics, these depressions. And the positive of the panics is that they were pretty short. So they cleared out malfeasance in the market. You typically had depressions that were under a year, but they were very severe. So a lot of people were laid off, were unemployed. And that was really the genesis of the idea behind the Federal Reserve, was how do we take the harshness out of the panics. So the idea of a commodity-based currency or a cryptocurrency, which is essentially a digital version of gold and silver or whatever, has been around for a while, but the argument that the bankers made was, we want to blunt the harshness of the panics. And most people don't have or didn't have the desire to go through kind of the clearing process that resulted from panic. So there is a benefit in using cryptocurrency or gold and silver, because it quickly, if you were to go by that standard and you're responsible, and you had your Bitcoin or you had your gold and silver, after panic, you'd be fine. But a lot of people aren't.
Well, I think it goes to the fact that gold and silver are global, and that's how cryptocurrencies are set up, as the same way as a global currency. So, and gold and silver is very finite. It's only what's in circulation. What has been mined, I guess, in a way. But it doesn't fit today's standards, though. You're not going to walk around with gold or silver.
They do in China.
And it's hard to store.
Like, you could ask Danny, I'm sure. An interesting article I read is that the yuan, I don't know, Danny, you could probably speak to this. The highest denomination of the yuan in U.S. dollars is pretty low. But if Chinese want to make larger purchases, they typically will go to their bank and convert their yuan into gold and make purchases using gold. So
I have a question on that point, though. Do they have to pay transaction fees in order to process it from being won into the gold?
No.
Do you comment on that? Just go into a bank and...
Danny may be able to speak to that a bit.
Honestly, I don't know. I haven't read into it before, and you know, when I was in China a few times, I never converted money into gold, but you know, I guess it's possible. I mean, I believe it, but you know, I'd never done it myself, so I haven't really heard much people doing that either when I was there too. So yeah, I don't know. Sorry, I don't really have much to say about that. So just kind of weird.
Yeah, because I've read articles that most large transactions in China are actually denominated in gold rather than yuan or used.
Well, do you remember where you read that?
What's that?
Do you remember where you read that at?
I would have to find the article. It was a couple months ago.
Because that sounds really interesting. I'd like to learn more about that.
Yeah, I'd like to read more about that. If anything, from what I've heard, you know, what other people from, you know, my family saying is, you know, from what their currency is backing up from is, we really don't know. They don't know. They didn't say it's backed from gold. Maybe it is, but, you know, the Chinese government is, you know, it's pretty shady too. It's, you know, not a lot of people know what they're doing. Probably less so than the U.S. actually, to be
honest. You don't say.
I mean, it's still got its communist roots, so you know, it shouldn't be really surprising,
right?
But I don't think fiat money in and of itself is the issue. It's just understanding who's sitting behind the driver's seat. You know, I mean, who has control over the money supply? That's the big issue.
I think fiat currency in itself makes that an issue.
Yes, yeah. Oh, absolutely it does. And I wouldn't necessarily trust the U.S. government more than I trust the Federal Reserve. But at least within the U.S. government, I mean, I guess we can maybe hope and pray that our votes matter.
Can vote people out when they make bad monetary decisions. So, and that's the essence of government is monetary supply and rule of law. And both have been eviscerated. But when a government is bought off by big businesses that do not want to see deflationary currency, that's where it, that's the fine line in the sand that people don't understand. They think inflation is a given. And it doesn't have to be that way.
And that's why Bitcoin is just so exciting, because there, the one thing that I don't know, because I haven't seen the code, I haven't seen the mathematical algorithms, so I would need to go into that more and probably talk to one of my, you know, more math nerdy friends and have them explain the formulas to me. But is that there's no person at the head. You can't buy anybody off. There's no agency running it. And that's what is just so exciting to me, because you're taking away this level of corruption that is evident within any other monetary structure. And so the question of monetary policy even becomes irrelevant. There is no policy. It is what it is. There are X amount of bitcoins that are produced, you know, every so often. And once you get to a certain point, it stops. And that's it. You know, there's no expanding or contracting. And yeah, does it have harsh swings right now? You bet it does. But it's brand new, and we do see a lot of panics and then a lot of interest, and it's very, very volatile at this point in time. But as the supply itself expands, we'll see more and more stability because it is global. And if we're going to have a panic, maybe if there's even a panic in the United States, that won't affect all of the cryptocurrency. And if people just understand the way panics affect the system, maybe we can make more informed decisions about how we spend.
With a lot of what you're saying right now, but I have to say this Dogecoin that's been expanding like crazy, it was founded on a joke. It was literally founded on a joke. The founders themselves
isn't the money in your wallet. The joke has no relevance to anything. All it is.
But what I'm saying is, I'm saying it's no better. I'm saying it's no better.
How do you figure? I mean, it's not like there's some dude at the top saying, "Oh, I'm going to contract the money supply and make everybody poor." And Dogecoin,
they absolutely have said that. They absolutely said that they will guaranteed release enough money, enough currency to make it worthless. That's what they've said. So there is manipulation going on, but they've just guaranteed that they're going to release enough to make it so that it's worth nothing.
Who's guaranteeing that? Who?
The owners of the cryptocurrency.
Of Dogecoin. That's an entirely different scenario.
Right,
and
but
no
it's still – Bitcoin has the same
– own the denominations.
But Bitcoin has the same –
It's an entirely different scenario. It's
Bitcoin has the same problems.
It shows how
can
it have
the same problems?
Started.
Because there's no CEO. There's no board of directors here. There's nobody saying we're going to make more, we're going to make less, or we're going to manipulate it in this way in terms of the supply or – where it's going, or we're going to hold on to it. No. There's absolutely nobody in control. The only person in control is anybody who owns a certain amount of whatever bitcoins they have. And, you know, money is really just perceived value. I'm making a bet. It's like owning a piece of stock. It's like, I assume that this is going to have a certain amount of value. And it's an investment. Whenever we own money, it's an investment. And whether or not we recognize that or not, it's just that we've gotten so used to the idea that a dollar, we're expecting that tomorrow that dollar is still going to be able to translate into goods and services. I'm going to be able to take this piece of paper and go get a car or go get my groceries. And that's just the trust that we have in it. And that's really what money is all about. It's perceived value. And if there's a limited supply of Bitcoin and there's nobody running the show, and it can't be manipulated by any governmental agency, no big business can buy it off. I mean, I don't see the weakness there.
Well, let's look at our American dollar, our Federal Reserve note. Our Federal Reserve note has only inflated and become worth less. I mean, from the last 100 years of the Fed's existence, what is the dollar worth what it was back then, only like worth 13 cents today? Is that, that's just off the top of my head. I don't know if you guys know any facts on it, but what'd you say, Eric?
That's about right.
Depreciated by about 99%.
If I wanted to argue against a creation like Dogecoin, that's exactly what the Federal Reserve has done over the last 100 years, is inflate the money supply to – it's not inflating the money supply. It's the fact that it's the fractional reserve banking system has inflated the money through
– Dogecoin's just based on the Litecoin foundation, right?
So yeah, that's Dogecoin to me was copied to Litecoin, only changed the parameters a little bit to make it more.
I think it's the same.
It's just like a new model out, I guess. And it's, but I have never seen that article or whatever you're talking about, Matt, where it's a joke, but even jokes can be created into something that actually comes,
you're talking about,
through the economy.
You're talking about Dogecoin?
Yeah.
Oh, the owners themselves, there's an entire thing on YouTube. I wish I had the clip here, but the guys themselves say, yeah, we started this as a joke. That's the whole reason they started it, because they're like, oh, it's a cryptocurrency, but we're going to start this. And they have said they're going to release enough of the currency to make sure that it doesn't become something that's worth far too much.
Well, that's their monetary policy.
That has nothing to do with Litecoin or Bitcoin at all.
Yeah, but that goes to show you how easily manipulated these currencies are as well.
No, that's
inaccurate,
because
with Bitcoin, there's a limited supply, and it's a mathematical formula. And at a certain point in time, they stop being created.
Well,
there is a limited supply.
That's where we're already at, though. That's where we're at now.
But well, drop $600 on a Bitcoin right now? When you could go drop, if you believe cryptocurrencies are the future, and you're looking at Bitcoin, $600, Litecoin, $40, and Dogecoin, and they see all these people making money from the ground up, you're always going to go to the lowest denominator until something sticks. I mean,
no, but
so
that's exactly what I'm trying to say. That's exactly what I'm trying to say, Kirk, that is not accurate. Like, Dogecoin itself,
what
is,
happens
if you pour your money into that,
if
they're
an
saying,
asteroid falls into Earth that's full of gold? The entire thing is gold. It's just double the amount of gold on
you're
Earth.
Not following me. I'm saying, like, the owners of Dogecoin have said, we're going to manipulate the market. They've said that. They're going to do it. They've been completely open and forward about what they're going to do with that currency. They're going to make sure that
and
it stays
low. And that's the exact problem. And
that's exactly
why
a replication of the Federal Reserve then.
Exactly why I would invest in Bitcoin, because there is no owner and there's nobody that can manipulate it. And that's the beautiful thing. I mean, I think that we should all be celebrating the fact that there's a currency out there that's not tied to any governmental agency. It's not tied to any for-profit company. I mean, it's completely liberating. We're untethered from the halves of the world manipulating the value of what we've worked so hard for. That's the entire point. There's nobody who could come in and screw with the value of what we've earned. And it's
so,
up to the people.
Globally,
determine and dictate the value of that currency. And it's all about supply and demand and perception. But it's not about government, and it's not about people in power screwing the rest of us.
I want to speak
to
that
real
quick, Chelsea.
Let's talk about the money supply of America.
Kirk,
I mean, the dollar was created.
Kirk,
let me
speak to that real quick. I have a question on all of the cryptocurrency. The one thing that, or the weakness that I've thought about, so you can, it's almost like what Kirk was talking about, the Goldfield's asteroid issue, and so it can, or in the 1800s where you had the 49er rush, or with silver where you had the Spanish silver rush in South America, is kind of inflation by bringing more of the commodity onto the market. But with cryptocurrency, I mean, there just seem to be so many options. What's to prevent somebody from creating, so you have Bitcoin, you have Litecoin, you can have gold coin, you can have shiny coin, you have Dogecoin. What's to prevent people from just moving money from one cryptocurrency to another without any real form of stability?
Liberty Southwest coin.
It should be what our liberty mindset is about, that competition breeds success and a more efficient form of business.
But there's an infinite amount of cryptocurrency.
Well, that's my point, but something will take off. Just like the American, there's 190, it's in the 190s currencies in the world, in on Earth here. And we are all spoiled because America has this dollar that the Federal Reserve, because of the influence they've started in Europe, created the dollar, and it's become the world's reserve currency. It's became the Bitcoin compared to Litecoin, to Dogecoin, to everything else, because every other currency in the world is very volatile. We're spoiled that our dollar fluctuates very limitless. I mean, it's got a limit to our fluctuation versus other currencies of other countries has vast amount of fluctuations that they have to deal with in their economies. So it's, all of a sudden you have something like Bitcoin that's global, and it becomes they're out of a more stable currency away from their own national currency. So if America said, hey, all right, no more dollar, we're only Bitcoin, then it'd be the same exact thing all over again. But as long as there's competition, it's all what people agree on as value. Money is an invention of just a means of trade, of a transaction, of my labor produced this, and I'm going to buy what your labor has produced. And
so it's about perception and trust, essentially.
I want to add something to that, too, because another thing is also like the network itself is really important. Like all these companies are now starting to accept Bitcoin. They're not going to accept Dogecoin or Litecoins. So there's a cryptocurrency that becomes successful gains a reputation. And so customers and companies will start to accept it, whereas they won't accept, you know, maybe Dogecoin. So if you had a bunch of money in Bitcoins and you wanted to transfer it over to Dogecoins, you're taking that risk. Because that could, you know, like Matt said, they're going to make enough of them so that it's eventually going to become worthless. So you're taking a risk by converting your Bitcoins into Dogecoins. So I think, another part of it that gives cryptocurrencies value is the network, too, because, you know, the name.
Well, that's what money is. It's an invention. It's just what – if you're willing to accept it. So, once businesses start accepting Bitcoin more and more, like there's a casino – in Vegas that accepts Bitcoin now. And so it has to be accepted. An invention as a money cannot work until the general populace accepts it as money. People today still don't think dollars are worth anything, and they'd still rather hold food or whatever barter resources they could have on hand, that they would much prefer anything solid and whatnot that they could barter for in case the whole dollar system crashes, which a lot of people have predicted, or this global financial meltdown that's supposedly coming. But it's it just goes back to the idea, and that's why I recommend talking about money policy, monetary policy, is that there's plenty of financial people that are totally fine with how the Federal Reserve runs, and they're not the Rothschilds. It's just, whether it's good or bad, doesn't really, it goes back to the principles and how you utilize it and how you control it. And for, we need money to function in today's economy. We've changed from a farm-based economy to a service-based economy. Or, I mean, we went from a farm-based economy to a manufacturing, and then now we're predominantly all service-based economy, which is a very weak gross national product. I mean, it's we're now, now we rely on all the other mining that goes on in the world for rare, for resources, wood, coal, oil, anything, plastic, rubber. Plastic's made out of oil and rubber and whatnot, but it's, we need these resources, and that's truly what an economy, you know, is. And America has gone to this service-based economy that's can be easily manipulated. And that's all I see is what government does today is they've created this. We've had this economy, and they keep doing all these little programs and whatnot that have no basis on anything. All they are service-oriented to make a better life, per se. And it's all interwoven and overlap now, and it can't change because it's so interwoven among society here, and it's the weakness America has become, and it can be exploited very easily. And monetary policy, from the initial clip, the Federal Reserve was the seventh bank, U.S. national bank that America founded, that our representatives in Congress that were hoodwinked into accepting this. And the public really had no idea and still has no idea about the true control behind the matter. And really, it is a coup of government. And I guess my point keeps going back to the service-based economy. I mean, look at all of our jobs. I don't know what everyone does here, but I would be willing to bet all of us work as in a service-based job. And how, yeah, all of us are as far
but
as
but there's
I can
nothing
tell.
Wrong. I mean, there's nothing like just like we talk about money, services in and of themselves are based on the perception of the value of the work. Mm-hmm. I mean, so I don't see and same thing with manufacturing. I mean, it's all about the perception of the value of the product itself. So I don't really see a big differentiation between a service based economy versus a manufacturing based economy. I don't.
Yeah, but a manufacturing based economy is actually producing something that's tangible, whereas the service is intangible.
It's a commoditized versus services being
a service based economy can be whitewashed away in a heartbeat.
It's all about the perception of the value. I mean, if you look at some of the manufacturing based economies, look at the hourly wages that they're paying those people a lot of times you'll see the manufacturing based economies in weaker economies. We've become service based because we became affluent. We had a lot of different advances technologically that allowed a lot of our processes to become either automated, or it was much cheaper to go overseas. Why was it cheaper? Because the people over there would accept wages that were, you know, less than a dollar an hour. And nobody in America is going to work for less than a dollar an hour. Hell, try to get somebody working for, you know, $5 an hour. Not going to happen, even if it was legal.
Yeah, but there's a thing called innovation and inventions that come out that change things. We're going into a robotic future. 3D printing, robotics. Everything is going back to a service.
Kirk,
well, here was my point, though.
Kirk, that's all coming out of the United States, or a good portion of that innovation is coming out of the quote-unquote service economy. When you look at...
So that's precisely it. That's my point, though. We are and always will be a service-based economy now in the future, because we will have machines doing the hard labor of the finite resources that are out there, producing the pellets to make plastics, to producing the metal, the sheet metal that we can make objects for. So there's a new enlightenment age coming of a society that is purely service-based and purely is going away from a labor-based system. So as we come to this age where jobs are going to be lost all over the place, there needs to be looked at is how can an economy stay afloat when all the jobs are being lost? Are we just going to tax to death the robot manufacturers to make the robots pricey? But it's
you move from manual labor to intellectual labor, and that involves education. There are there are plenty of jobs for highly educated labor, and there always will be.
Doing what?
And that's the problem that we're seeing right now. That's what they call the employment gap.
Are you kidding? I got something to say about that, though. College, you go anywhere. You could go to a Starbucks. I bet every person working in a Starbucks has a college education.
They're liberal arts.
We're way overeducated.
We have wrecked.
We are way overeducated.
No,
I don't agree with that. Kirk?
That is untrue.
I think it's untrue, too. We have...
There are jobs in engineering...
We have wrecks that go open
because they don't
over
have enough people to fill them because people hate math and they don't want to take math.
STEM.
I mean,
I am an engineer. I went through it all. You don't learn how to fulfill the job at hand. You need the experience that you learn doing the job.
What were you?
The education is very as changed dramatically, and the job sites have changed dramatically because there's such a shortage of the people that you actually need to fulfill the jobs that you need to complete, that you need that education, and there's a plethora of that out there. The people, we're going to become very stagnant because the people that rise up through the ranks are going to be filled, but there's a massive amount of people out there. The mass at large is only going to shrink, I mean, become poorer and poorer because the jobs that, because of this debt system, that because we need to go to college, you need to get in debt. Everything is all about debt now. When we all grew up, I guarantee we all got jobs when we were in grade school, high school, and whatnot. Kids today have to fight for these jobs because adults are taking these jobs that they used to work. And so my point is this whole monetary policy is that there's going to come to a point in the future that we need money to be circulated. And it needs to be agreed upon that that people still accept the value of it. And cryptocurrency is the foot through the door, in my opinion, because I didn't understand Bitcoin very much until I heard about how the mining process works. I thought, you know, it was actually doing a function that was needed in society, you know, the computer functioning or whatnot. You just log on to this network that's forming this supercomputer that hammers out some equations that are worthwhile. No, all it is a little game pretty much. But it's accepted value. The people that win, that's every 15 minutes, that actually win 25 bitcoins as what's currently released, is people accept that as, all right, you won, you get that money. So that's why, picture a future where if it's all service-based and the hard labor is all robotics, and you can produce anything from at home if you just have a simple design, all you need is the resources. There's going to need to be a system like Bitcoin set up that it's a lottery system or something, that this amount of money is going into the circulation, into the public, and people still accept it as value for exchanging goods and services, I guess. But it's the future is coming very fast, and the arguments that are laid before us right now I think are very irrelevant from what, and the true groundwork is being laid behind the scenes, and I do not see our current monetary policy or current system around like a commodity of value of dollars and gold or a commodity based currency will not suffice for the future is what I'm saying if we are continue down this service based economy.
Eric, what were you going to add earlier?
As far as...
Oh, we were talking about education and the employment gap.
Yep.
And you were going to say something along those lines, I think.
Sure. Yeah, I know in my field and in other fields, we often have job requisitions that stand open for over a year because of lack of qualified candidates. And in my mind, what's that?
That was precisely my point. The jobs have changed into being more and more qualified. the education behind the people are there. It's the basis of that job is out there, but you're not qualified because you still don't have the experience.
There is that. I would agree with that. Yeah, because again, kind of the lower level experience is at least 10 years, and they're just, you know, there is a dearth of candidates. So they're, you know, in my opinion, there's something to be said for high level technical engineering professional education that's always going to reap rewards for individuals, and that's, you know, as we move forward, it's going to be more of an engineering economy, and you know, and I don't think there will ever be a lack of jobs for smart, innovative individuals who want to participate in that area, and that simply brings, you know, the opportunity for people to get out of the manual labor environments, which are going to be, like you said, increasingly automated through robotics and refined industrial practices. So we certainly are in a, it's kind of like the change between the agrarian society and industrial society in the 1800s. Mid-1800s, 1850s, 1860s, 1870s, we're going through a change, and people became educated in the newer skill sets, and they were fine. And I think that'll be the case now. I don't think it's much of a monetary issue as much as it is an educational issue.
I can only agree.
And I think
with
difficulty lies with employers themselves, because they refuse, like, okay, so we've gotten very accustomed to the idea that in a manufacturing society, it doesn't take a whole lot of training to teach someone how to run a machine. And maybe that's a very ignorant statement on my part, but it takes a lot less training, I could say that, than it would to become a high-level engineer. And the issue is that with our education system, as Kirk said, you know, we're not preparing people to actually do the job. And I know so many people with college degrees that have difficulty finding jobs because they don't have experience. They'll have a four-year degree that they paid a lot of money for.
A lot of more liberal arts degrees.
Loans for, but that it doesn't prepare them for the job itself.
Communications?
One thing, communications, English, history,
yeah,
you name
exactly.
It.
Yeah, you need hard skills.
I think the issue is that employers have got a little cozy in the fact that they don't need to spend a lot of time training people. And now I'm not putting this all on the employers. I am an employer myself, so I'm not saying that the employer should bear all this burden, but there should be something. We need something to transition into this age, and either the universities need to start doing a better job of preparing people for the occupation itself, and whether that's partnering with businesses, I don't know. There are many, many different models that we could throw out there. But there is an issue at hand that education, even though you might pay $150,000 for it, isn't preparing you to step into a position and do the job.
I feel like that's a topic for another day.
Yep.
Points.
So maybe we should cut this off and talk monetary policy like every show. We got plenty to go. I think if we go back and listen to this, we'll figure out how we're to expand upon it right now. That,
All right. Thank you.
I think it's gotten lost in topics. It's gotten.
So is cryptocurrency is that the future? Is that kind of the consensus over, you know, the Federal Reserve? Well,
I hope so.
Well, my personal opinion is this is a stepping stone to get us used to something of the sort, just like a dollar had to be got used to as a form of currency. I think cryptocurrency, I don't know if Bitcoin is going to be it, but I think this is setting the ground stage for a global currency that will be end up being controlled by, say, the IMF or something.
That would be the end of it all. That does not sound good to me. So, like, when I say that I'm an advocate for Bitcoin, it's not. I don't like when I originally thought about electronic currency, I detested the idea. The fact that I mean, the government can see so far into our lives as it is between Facebook or Twitter or whatever the case is. Imagine that they could eliminate paper money and everything was electronic and everything was tracked. That's bullshit. And I don't like it. I'm not comfortable with it. But with Bitcoin, the reason that I find it so exciting and so appealing is the fact that you can have anonymous transactions. What was it? $150 million. There was a $150 million transaction with Bitcoin, and nobody knows who it was. And I love that, and it's not controlled by a government. There's no manipulation. There's no corruption. And that's a beautiful thing. Now,
anything can be manipulated. That's the problem. But that's the given. There's good and bad in everything. And the point was that this definitely is the future, a cryptocurrency. No matter what we say or anything, the cryptocurrency is going to be the future. And so the best way to argue about against something controlling it like the Federal Reserve is to talk about our current money supply and how that's created and educate the public about how our money supply is controlled and manipulated as it is currently. So when a cryptocurrency takes over, that we don't get ensnared into the same scheme that we are in under with our U.S. Federal Reserve note. If we could educate people to talk more about money supply, to debate it, just have it in people's minds, it will be that much harder for that new cryptocurrency that takes over the globe to be ingrained in such devious measures as to be able to governments to control. Really, it's not controlling the governments; it's controlling the money supply, which controls the people, which controls the government. And and then once that is created, then all you need to do is control the politicians. But it has to flow one way, and then you flow through a tyranny. And is how the Federal Reserve System is set up. And so we need to talk more about monetary policy. It's a boring subject, and people very grossly misunderstand it. And it's all I'm trying to say is just be forward thinking that a cryptocurrency is definitely the way of the future, and we need to combat it to be controlled by a certain entity that all of a sudden, oh, all right, we need to take out bonds from a government that indebts them, because there's no indebtedness to cryptocurrency quite yet, besides giving up. Yeah, it's not, you're not in debt to any cryptocurrency. No one is in debt to a cryptocurrency, and that's the defining fact, that our dollars are debt. We have to pay those dollars back. Our government has to pay those dollars back, and that is control.
Well, then, ladies and gentlemen,
I have one more question, and actually, I think Mike might be able to answer this. So, Mike, have you followed kind of the price of Bitcoin over the last month or so?
Yeah, it's about 510 right now.
So what, and you probably know what went on with Mt. Gox, or there's been some volatility in the Bitcoin area where some exchanges didn't Bitcoin on Mt. Gox drop down to under $200 within the last week or so?
I'm not sure. I mean, I haven't really been following it that closely, but I know they did experience some flash crashes, and they've been having problems with people hacking into Bitcoin wallets, which is another thing. I mean, I'm all for cryptocurrencies and everything, but, I mean, if you can't hold it in your hand, honestly a little bit – that paranoids me quite a bit, which is why I'm more of a fan of, like, commodity-backed currencies. Because I think, you know, those also impose a natural
limit
on government's ability to spend.
How did every recession happen in America before? It was all by banks holding the gold. They wouldn't give it back out. They took the gold that people would store, and then they took it away, and the money supply dropped precipitously.
It was more credit fueled rather than any type of conspiracy by the banks. You know, most depressions or recessions are caused by moral hazard or investment malfeasance rather than banks, you know, pulling out the money supply. But yeah, that was one of the
things. They said it in their minutes. They said we're sorting in the money supply. We're going to create a recession. It's in it's back before anything they ever have envisioned something called the internet.
Yeah,
where they can control the information. But it was definitely a fact that they took out. They withheld the money to create the things, the issues. So when politicians argued against forming these state banks, the banks purposely went out and shortened the money supply.
Yeah,
and that's how you, even any commodity can still be manipulated.
Yeah,
very easily, and probably easier than a cryptocurrency, here's what Bitcoin is. Everyone's involved right now because this is so early. Everyone treats it like right now as like baseball cards or a stock. Everyone is mostly interested in seeing that value go from $100 to $200 and doubling their money. That is the only thing right now, and so everyone's still thinking in dollars. That's the whole point, is Americans are only seeing it as an investment. They're not considering it a currency to trade it.
Well, it's the same thing.
Because once it becomes a currency but I don't know. That's just my point on cryptocurrency.
Yeah, but I get what you're trying to say. Like, banks can hoard gold and silver, but I don't really see what would stop them from hoarding Bitcoin. So I think, honestly, anyone can hoard anything. And, you know, to benefit themselves at the expense of others, I don't think a cryptocurrency is going to be immune from that either.
Exactly.
Well, banks can hoard bitcoins. That's the entire point. It's not in a bank account. It's in your account.
You don't have to go through it. Yeah, we all are.
And if you want to be, and it's sort of like your own wallet. You talk about these electronic wallets and how they were hacked into. Well, you think about your own wallet. You want to leave it sitting on a counter. Yeah, there's a greater chance that somebody's going to come along and steal it. You know, you can put protections in yourself, and it's part of being a responsible person is not leaving your cash sitting around or not leaving your cryptocurrency without the extra passwords that would require someone to be able to access them.
There's fail-safe measures to, even if someone hacked your wallet, they still couldn't spend it by having extra passwords. But
what stops you from throwing away your hard drive that's worth like $11.5 million?
Oh, and there's that. But that's just
there,
being a dumbass.
There will always be irresponsible people. You cannot.
Yeah. Oh,
come on!
You can't hold people to that kind of standard.
Oh no! I'm. That's exactly what I'm saying. I'm not holding them to that standard. There's always going to be people in this world that are irresponsible or foolish.
Well, and here's the other thing. How are you going to get robbed? If your money's all electronic, you can't get robbed if you only know the password. You have to be coerced into giving out your password. But you can't just be physically robbed in a sense. You'd have to be mentally robbed.
Yeah, you can't be mugged. I'm going to go hanging around in Harlem at 12 o'clock at night.
Yeah, more dollars are lost daily than by crime and theft than any cryptocurrency will ever see. That's currently today.
Hi, Kirk. My name is Matt. I'm calling you from BitTorrent / Bitcoin Services. I'm interested in unlocking your account that just got locked up. Could you please confirm to me what your password is?
Oh, I will. That. Yes.
1, 2, 3, 4.
Let me just hand over my social security number while you're asking.
Did I just catch a niner in there?
Yeah,
niner.
Figure that one out, buddy.
Ladies and gentlemen, I think this is probably a great segue to end our topic for the evening. Thank you all very much for joining us. Yeah, to be continued. Thank you all for joining us. This has been Eric Taylor. Chelsea Cuomo, is that right? Come on.
Mike
Lenz, yeah. Yeah, great. Mike Lensgrave, Kirk Pettis, Danny Nick, and Lydia Tabbitt, and of course I'm Matt Winter. Thank you for joining us tonight. Goodbye.
Good night.
Bye, everyone.